This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 100 was recorded on January 11th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. Josh Steiner is Managing Director of the Financials Research Team at HedgEye. Josh will be joining me as this week's featured interview guest when the topic will be housing bubbles around the globe. We'll examine the Canadian real estate situation first, then Australia, and finally return to the United States. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview when Patrick and I will be back to discuss our own reactions to the housing situation as well as some trades that Patrick's been working on with his members.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 once again isn't disappointing with a big surge higher. We're now trading around the 2766 level on the S&P 500. It really feels like there's a magnet to this 2800 here, and the market just keeps plugging toward it. What's your take on the market here?
Well, as we've said in the last couple of weeks, I think we're in that final stage of the bull market where basically fundamentals go out the window. It's all about sentiment. This is where retail usually piles in, don't want to miss out, and it's where the institutional professionals are usually selling their positions to retail traders who get stuck holding the bag at the end. I don't think it's anywhere close to over yet. You know, the old saying is, as goes January, so goes the year. I think as goes January, which has been straight up, is likely to be probably true of how goes the first half of this year. But I won't be surprised if we see a major reversal. David Rosenberg was out this week saying, hey, we're at least at the seventh inning here. You know, it's not over yet. It's not the bottom of the ninth, but we're getting close. I wouldn't be surprised if we have another 1,000 points of upside on the S&P. But when it gets ugly, it could get real ugly. And of course, timing these things is impossible. Something I think could play a role in this is a cryptocurrency angle. If cryptocurrency, let's say hypothetically that Bitcoin recovers from its current situation and makes new highs above 20,000. You know, where the buyers usually come in order to fuel the final stage of a bull market is those retail investors and a lot of first-time retail investors. Now, since the age demographic which would typically supply this is millennials, and that millennial demographic tends to like to do things differently than their parents did. If cryptos are still taking off, I could see the crypto bubble replacing the final parabolic move up in the stock market because millennials will say, hey, investing in stocks, that's something my grandfather did. I'm gonna do the new way of doing things. I'm going to go invest in cryptos and get rich there. And I think that's going to end very badly as well, unfortunately. On the other hand, let's say the trend towards outlawing cryptocurrencies continues. There's a crash in Bitcoin down below $500. It's washed out. Well, in that case, I think it could accelerate and exacerbate the upside in the stock market because that's the point where the millennials say, okay, the stock market is the place to be. It's still going up. Cryptos didn't work out. That's where I want to go and rush with reckless abandon into. But we are at that reckless abandon stage. I don't know how long it lasts. As I've said many times before, if you're going to play this market in either direction, for crying out loud, options are cheaper than they've ever been. You can buy optionality, limit your downside, still participate in the upside, and I just think that's the way to go. Speaking of which, we've had a few emails about the ratio call spread strategy, which you told us about, Patrick, several shows ago. And the question is, tell us exactly which that show that was so we can go back and listen to it again. Folks, we don't know either, unfortunately. We keep accurate records of all of our feature interview topics. We don't remember which show that was, so we're going to have to do it again. So next week in our post-game segment, I'm going to ask Patrick to review in more detail both the ratio call spread as well as other option strategies for playing the upside that still may exist in this stock market. So stay tuned for that next week.
Oh, absolutely. We'll do a good job and just review everything for all of our listeners. But let's move on to the U.S. dollar index. And right now, that dollar index has weakened right back down towards the bottom end of its range, testing very close to that 91.50 level. Do you think it gives out here? Are we going to a lower low here?
Well, that's the question for sure that we need to be paying attention to. It looked for me like, hey, we're starting to build a base there at around 91.50, 91.60, you know, a little bit above the 91 level, which is the key level where the prior low was. Maybe we're seeing a base forming after all. It was looking pretty good until today. Now we're right back down to that 91.50 level. So we're on the edge, and I think it needs to be watched carefully. I see either possibility from here. I did see the beginnings of what looked to me like a base forming process, but as we broke out above that base, now we're right back down to it. So, you know, we're going to see head fakes in either direction. The key is when we see a break and a daily close below 91, that's your bearish indication, which is looking more likely at this point. The solid bullish indication wouldn't be until we had a daily close above 97, which would be the 61.8 retrace of the move down from 103. If that's going to happen, it's obviously a ways off. But we'll wait and see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude oil just surged right up toward about 64.50 today. Just looked like it was ripping higher, and then it gave it all back by the end of the day. Was that the top there? Where do you think oil's going from here?
Well, 62.58 was a really important line in the sand. That was the 2015 high. And remember, what happened was we had the fall of 2014. Things really accelerated with the Thanksgiving massacre, with the OPEC meeting, really heavy, heavy selling. And then the dead cat bounce off of December 14 into spring of 15 got up to 62.58. So to break above that level is a pretty significant technical indication. A lot of people, including Goldman Sachs, thought 62.58 was going to be the top. We broke decisively above that level on Tuesday, well before inventory data came out. Then when API, which is the private inventory service, forecast an 11 million barrel drawdown on crude oil inventories, that really sent prices to the moon, going all the way up to 63.50. When EIA came out with the official inventory data, it wasn't, and that's of course Wednesday morning at 10:30, it wasn't 11 million barrels. It was only 4.9 million barrels. So that's less than half. Cushing, Oklahoma, still drawing down 2.4 million barrels. That's the second 2 million plus barrel draw in as many weeks. And of course, the spill is over, so it's not Keystone Pipeline related. So, you know, really big drawdowns still happening in Cushing, but a much smaller one than we expected to see on a national level, at least based on API. Gasoline and distillates both building. Gasoline 4.1 million barrels, distillates 4.3 million barrels. Now, the downside spike that was inevitable in response, of course, to the much smaller than expected drawdown, you know, 11.1 million barrels from API versus 4.9 actual, lasted less than 5 minutes, Patrick. And before we knew it, the market was moving higher. So I see this as a market that's been looking for excuses to go higher, not lower. If it wanted an excuse to go lower, certainly 4.9 instead of 11 million barrels on the drawdown would have been it. The thing I think that may have helped to propel it to the upside was production down substantially. Now, normally, for the last several weeks, we've been seeing 25, 30,000 barrels per day on a weekly basis of increase in production. We saw 290,000 barrels per day decrease, back down below 9.5 million barrels per day of domestic production. So that's like 10 weeks worth of gains taken out in 1 week. 1 week does not make a trend, though. I don't really have any background to analyze what the nature of this and whether it's an anomaly, but I suspect it's probably an anomaly. I don't think we have a major trend of production turning down, but certainly that was the excuse if you were looking for an excuse to go higher, and that's what happened. As far as the big picture, well, what got us here was really a perfect storm, if you will, of circumstances. We've got the situation in Iran. Of course, the threat of more sanctions is a big part of it. Although the protests in Iran have nothing to do with oil production directly, you know, there's a potential that you could see a revolution and a regime change in Iran. And of course, that could change everything. So the Iran situation is one. Bitterly cold U.S. weather, increased demand for natural gas and heating oil, of course, is a direct result of that. You had the Forties pipeline as well as the Libyan pipeline situation. Both of those have now been fixed, but they contributed to this big price rally that we've seen. Rapidly, rapidly declining U.S. inventories, including really big Cushing, Oklahoma drawdowns for now. I'll come back to that in just a minute. And of course, the rig count being flat to down for the last few weeks. And the final point, of course, is OPEC, at least as of a few weeks ago, had been jawboning the market higher, and there was all the excitement out of the OPEC production cuts and so on and so forth. So all of these things come together that have created a perfect storm, if you will, that I think has gotten us up to this point. The thing is, Patrick, I think we might be setting up a perfect storm in the other direction. It's not here yet, perhaps, but I think it might be coming.
All right, well, don't keep us in suspense. Like, what do you see as the perfect storm here?
Well, remember what I said last week about OPEC. I said the thing to watch for is OPEC doesn't want prices at $75 or $80. They know that that leads to a complete restart of the shale revolution in the United States. They don't want that. Now, that already started this week. Not too many people noticed it, but the Iranian oil minister made comments to say, hey, we don't want to go much further here. Iran is not really who's getting the attention, but just wait and see what the reaction is if Russia or Saudi Arabia start to jawbone markets in the other direction. So I think we're seeing maybe that that's coming, that we're getting to that point. Meanwhile, we've got all-time record long speculative interest in Brent and WTI and a 10-to-1 speculative long-to-short ratio. For every short in the crude oil market, there's 10 longs in terms of speculative managed money trading. So even if they're right, even if the price needs to go up from here, there's nobody left to go long. There needs to be some kind of a pullback. Whether it is a major trend reversal or just a short-lived pullback, that I don't know. But something has to change here. We've got a record number now of commercial shorts, and we also know that a huge amount of hedging has already happened. We can tell that, of course, from the commitment of traders reports. We can tell that, of course, from where the commercial swap dealers column shows us the hedging activity. Now, the question you have to ask is, was that hedging activity to finance new drilling, or was it to roll forward maturing bonds? I don't know how to tell that in advance, but if you want to know, the real answer eventually comes in rig count. When does it come in rig count? Well, it's been very reliable that if you lag the WTI price by 3 months, that's going to correspond to rig count. When did this big upside price acceleration start? October 9th. Add 3 months, what do you get? This week. So we should look for the rig count to start to tick up. I don't know if it's exactly this week. These things are not that precise. But in the next several weeks, I would expect to see rig count starting to tick up. And I was going to say, my plan today was to say, I don't think it's over yet, Patrick. I think we've still got a little bit more upside in this market because we've got the 200-month moving average, which is at 65 spot 11. We've also got the 50% retrace of the big move from 2014 to 2016. That's at 66 spot 85. We saw a $70 Brent today. I was thinking, you know, maybe at the outside, if this thing really takes off from here, maybe we'll get to $70 WTI as well. And if you really wanted to reach, you could say the 61.8% Fibonacci retrace of the big move from 2014 to 2016. I don't have the number in front of me, but it's probably around 72 or 73. That's the range of possibility. I was kind of leaning towards that 50% retrace number of 66 spot 85. The thing is, Patrick, today's close, boy, shooting star candle pattern, and that came after breakout to 64 spot 75. A failed attempt to retrace back up to that level fell short and rolled over, and then a very strong sell-off into the futures close to end up with a shooting star candle, which of course is a reversal candle pattern that's indicated when you have the price at the open and the price at the close almost the same, just a little bit difference, with a huge up movement, you know, big up day that reverses back and you close where you started. That's what we saw today. That much of the time is a reversal candle pattern. So maybe at least for now, this is over. Of course, topping is a process. It's not always an event. So maybe this is the short-term top and we're still going to see one more, you know, move down to 62 or so, and then another final move up that goes and touches that 66.85 level. We'll see what happens, but I think that we're getting close to the end of the process here. When it does reverse, though, baby, it could get ugly, and I think especially if the proximal trigger is aggressive jawboning by OPEC, if you get Russia and Saudi Arabia out in force saying, hey, this has gone far enough, we need to rethink this whole production cut thing, and maybe we should terminate it in June after all. If they were to say that publicly, I think this would be over in a hurry. And when it's over, you've got that 10-to-1 ratio of longs to shorts. It starts unwinding. You could see a very dramatic move to the downside happen very, very quickly.
You know, I couldn't agree more. And I do think that we're pretty much slowly approaching those upper end of the ranges, it's probably going to be a process, but we're definitely at a very mature stage of that move. But let's move on to gold, because the negative reciprocal move of the U.S. dollar to the gold is almost like tick to tick working. U.S. dollar down, gold up. I mean, where's gold going from here?
Well, I think that's exactly what it's all about. I think the dollar is the driver in this picture right now. And I think that the reason the gold rally has paused where it's paused is because the dollar appears to have paused and might be finding a base there at 91.50, 91.60 or so on the dollar index. If we see a break below 91, I think gold is going straight up. And I think that if we see a sustained reversal, in other words, we keep testing this 91.50 level, we end up breaking above it, and we stay, let's say, above 92.50 or 93 for 2 or 3 days, I think at that point, gold would roll over. So I don't really have a view on gold. I think it's a question of wait and see on the dollar, and the gold is going to react in the opposite direction.
Well, let's move on to 10-year Treasury yields, because on Tuesday, we had that huge breakout above the 2.5 level, surging it up to 260. What's your thinking here on interest rates?
Well, you know, you heard it first on Macro Voices, all that crazy talk with those conspiracy theory nutcases, Luke Grauman and Mark Yusko, talking about China maybe doing something completely unheard of, like not buying any more treasuries. Well, guess who the latest conspiracy theorist is? Yes, Chinese government. Hey, conspiracy theory just turned into conspiracy fact. How about that? And actually, I think China is refuting that now, saying it was a fake news story. But my take is, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. That didn't come out of nowhere. Maybe whoever said it wasn't supposed to say it, or they regret saying it or whatever. But I think that we are seeing signs that China is questioning whether or not continuing to hold U.S. treasuries as a strategic reserve asset makes any sense. And that certainly is confirming the forecast that Luke Grauman particularly has made on this program in his interviews, as well as in our year-end special. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Right now, we're only at 254. I think that's because we had the denial come out where China said maybe it's a fake news story. We'll see what happens. I think if this is confirmed, it really kind of changes my view a little bit, because I've had some skepticism, no doubt in my mind, that Mark and Luke are visionary guys. I think they're right about the dollar. I just thought they were too early. I didn't think it was time yet for China to be making major moves like divesting itself completely of treasuries. Maybe that really is starting to happen. Maybe this was just fake news, as people are saying. We're getting to the point, though, where it's starting to look more and more real day by day. So I'll be paying close attention.
Absolutely. Now, before we move on to our featured interview with Josh Steiner, just wanted to cover a couple of quick housekeeping items. What was on your mind?
Well, donations have been pouring in since the year-end series. Everybody just absolutely loved our year-end series, and I can't tell you how much we appreciate all the positive feedback. I'm very proud of that one. I think it was a great series. And if these donations continue, we're going to have funding that we can use to produce more extracurricular content in timeless series, things other than the weekly podcast. One potential possibility for that would be season 2 of Eurodollar University. I've talked to Jeff Snyder about this, and you know, that whole series, even though it was meant to be the end after part 4, it only takes you up to the history of Eurodollars before the system broke down in 2007. And I said, Jeff, why didn't you cover the breakdown at the end of part 4? And he said, well, because that would have been 4 more parts. And I said, oh, okay, well, maybe we should do four more parts. So we could do a second season of Eurodollar University and cover the breakdown of the Eurodollar system and what the knock-on effects have been in the financial system since 2007. Or we could look for a new topic to keep things interesting and so forth. Since we pride ourselves in being a listener-driven program, I want the people who are actually footing the bill for this, the generous donations that we're receiving, the people who are making them, to have some say in this. So we need to know, what is it that you liked so much about the year-end show? Was it the fact that we had multiple expert guests in the same podcast expressing contrasting views and having a polite discourse with one another? Was it the fact that we took an interesting subject like the future of the dollar and really spent the time necessary to go deep on it? Or was it something else? Let us know when you donate, when you use our donate form. There's a place to put a comment in. If you're making a donation, we would love to know what your desires are for how that money be spent in terms of what kind of content you would like to see us develop. Now, I know what you're thinking. You're a cheapskate and you don't want to make a donation, but you still want to send your request to us. No, we're going to let the people who are footing the bill decide this. Now, if you are a prior donor and you've donated to Macro Voices before, by all means, send us an email at info@macrovoices. Tell us you're a prior donor so we can look up your email address and verify that. And by all means, let us know your desires. But we're going to go by the requests of people who are making the donations and have made them in the past, and that will decide what we spend the money on in terms of additional content in the coming year.
All right. Well, let's move on. This week's featured interview guest is Josh Steiner, Managing Director of Financial Research at HedgeEye. Now, Eric's interview with Josh Steiner is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Josh Steiner, who heads up the entire financials research department at HedgeEye. Part of that, of course, is the housing sector research, and that's what we're going to focus on today. Patrick has been looking for a guest for some time who could really talk intelligently to the various different housing bubbles that we see forming around the world. And Josh, I've got to hand it to you. I love interviewing HedgeEye guys because you always come with fantastic slide decks. Folks, you're not going to want to miss this download. If you are a registered user at macrovoices.com, the download link is in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for the link to get the downloads next to Josh's picture on our homepage. Josh, I want to start, before we dive into your excellent slide deck here, with a really high-level picture, which is, what is the macroeconomic thesis of why is it that it seems like these resource-rich countries like Canada and Australia are very prone to having housing bubbles and that these bubbles seem to just keep blowing up for a long time? What's going on here? What's the big picture?
I think it's a good question to start with, but I would actually disagree slightly with the premise. I think most people look at countries like Canada and Australia and tend to think of them as being resource-driven economies, and I think up until about 10, 15 years ago, that was definitely the case. But our work has shown that really in the last 10-plus years, and especially in the last 5 years, these are largely fire-driven economies. We've looked at the contribution to both the economy at large, the share of growth in the economy from financing, insurance, real estate, construction across both Australia and Canada, and we've sort of likened them to one-cylinder engines where really the bulk of growth is being derived from appreciation in sort of collective property values, financing of it, the insuring of it, the construction of it, and the wealth effect sort of created thereby. And so, you know, I think definitely looking back through time, there's certainly a resource-driven component, and that's still there. But when you really sort of dissect the sort of source of the growth for these countries over the last half decade, pretty surprising just how much of it has come from the property markets.
So I want to cover Canada, Australia, and the United States in this interview. Why don't we start with Canada and dive into your slide deck? It looks like starting on page 3, you've got an excellent sequence of slides focusing on the Canadian real estate situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, just if I can put in a little plug here, you know, when we do these decks here at HedgeEye, they tend to be anywhere from 100 to 150 slides. And so I've really sort of selected 10, 15 slides for each of these respective markets, but suffice it to say that there's a lot more to it than what we've got here. But I think the slides I've selected are a pretty nice cross-section and sort of a reference point, at least for starting to think about what's going on across some of these different markets. So if we take a look at Canada, maybe start on slide 4, I think there's a lot of slides out there, presentations certainly that I've seen, that draw some sort of overlays between the Canada and U.S. and other markets just for sort of context. And frankly, we've done that here as well, but I think we've tried to do it through a slightly different lens. So on slide 4, basically what we're looking at here is residential investment, the share of GDP expressed here in terms of standard deviation relative to the longer-term average. And so we're basically looking at Canada relative to the U.S. and can see that Canada has been steadily grinding higher really since about 12, 13 years ago and is now at a level just shy of where the U.S. Peaked at in late 2005. And then if we go to the next slide, slide 5, I think this one sort of speaks volumes to, you know, when you think about property markets and you sort of ask the question, are they in fact bubbles? And if so, how do I attempt to gauge when they're sort of at that peak point, ready to go the other way? Really what you're sort of looking for is, you know, what is sort of referred to as this Minsky moment, meaning when things, you know, truly sort of go, you know, nonlinear or parabolic. And I think this slide on 5 does a decent job of sort of reflecting that. And what we're showing here is the share of Canadian GDP attributable simply to ownership transfer costs, which are just broker commissions, real estate broker commissions. And, you know, we show it in percentage terms on the left axis and in standard deviation terms on the right. And relative to its sort of longer-term 40-year history, currently we're north of 3 standard deviations. And if you go to the next slide, slide 6, and you look again, sort of compare and contrast with the U.S., I think there's sort of an eerie similarity between really what's happened just in the last 4 years, which is where that sort of Minsky component comes in Canada, and where the U.S. was. So the parallels are pretty uncanny. Third quarter 2005 ownership transfer costs relative to U.S. GDP reached just over 3 standard deviations, and Canada, as of early 2017, had reached a similar level. So these are slides that from our deck we put together in August of 2017. So we're a few quarters out of date, but obviously this is a longer-term phenomenon, and I think the message is very clear. Nobody should be surprised by this next slide, slide 7, which just shows sort of the growth in household or private mortgage debt in the U.S. relative to Canada. Obviously, Canada continues up and to the right here. And then if we look at home prices on slide 8, pretty much a steady trajectory in Canada, really up until about a year and a half ago. And then just in the last, really in 2016, late 2015, 2016, 2017, you really started to see Canadian home prices begin to sort of take off and certainly have moved well out of range relative to certain sort of anchor points like DPI on slide 9. So there's a lot of policy change that's taking place in Canada. We've sort of laid that out on slides 10 and 11. I think a couple of the bigger ones were these foreign buyer taxes implemented in Vancouver, and then more recently across the Golden Horseshoe. But you know, the one that's sort of top of mind at the moment are these B20 guidelines or rules that have been put in place effective really just about a week ago. And we think the B20 rules, which effectively make it harder to qualify for a traditional mortgage from an underwriting standpoint because the rate at which you need to qualify is now meaningfully higher, also harder to source down payments through sort of non-traditional means. Both those factors are coming at a time when affordability is already at sort of extreme levels, or unaffordability, I should say, or at extreme levels, and you've got a bit of a waning in foreign demand coming in. We're sort of at a critical time here in thinking about Canadian property and whether these gains that have been realized over the last several years are even remotely sustainable. So, yeah, I won't go into all the slides because I think you know, there's a lot here, and I don't want to put people to sleep. But a few things I would call out is that in the twilight of these property cycles, historically, one of the things you see sort of without fail is a sort of wholesale shift in terms of the financing structure in these markets. And so if we go to slide 15, I do think it's notable that when you look at, for instance, the share of loans being sourced by mortgage brokers, even just moving from 2016 to 2017, those shares have risen very significantly. So for instance, first-time buyers in 2016, just about a quarter of them sourced their loans through mortgage brokers. And then in 2017, that number had risen all the way to 35%. I mean, that's a very marked shift in a relatively short span of time. And then a lot of people talk about the foreign buyer component and what's going on. And this, in a way, comes back to sort of the resource-driven component of the original question. If you go to slide 16, I think this sort of encapsulates what's happening there reasonably succinctly. So essentially what happened, right, is in mid-2014, oil peaked. It basically sold off very aggressively up until around February 2016. During that time frame, Canadian currency lost a significant amount of its value relative. And so you saw, not surprisingly, foreign buyers really sort of pile in to the Canadian property market. And so here on slide 16, we're showing the Canadian dollar relative to the U.S. dollar and what sort of happened coincidentally in both the Toronto and Vancouver markets. And so as you saw the sort of blowback from that energy-driven weakness, it really attracted foreign investment. I think that's something to keep in mind when you think about foreign investment. I'll talk more about that later when we sort of look at Australia, but I do think we're sort of on the other end of that and on the sort of the wrong end, I guess, from a bullish housing frame.
Let me ask a couple questions about the Canadian situation before we move on to Australia. As I look at all these slides, I guess that when I think about the psychology of a bubble, it seems to me like the way they work is it starts with everybody thinks that something bad is not possible. You know, the famous comment from Ben Bernanke in 2005 about how housing has never gone down across the board, couldn't happen. Nobody's worried about it. And then there's a catalyst. In the case of the U.S. housing market, it was in the first quarter of 07, there was a big wave of adjustable rate mortgage resets where all of a sudden people's payments went up dramatically. And that was kind of that catalyst that caused everybody to wake up and say, wait a minute, this is crazy. And then, of course, the rest is history. So what I tend to look for is, first, how is it possible in Canada? I mean, obviously, the U.S. housing bust was big news. Everybody knows about that. So everybody knows it's possible. It seems like it's going anyway. A lot of it maybe is driven by foreign buyers. So what would we be looking for as investors for the catalyst that's going to pop this bubble where, you know, it's not going to be adjustable rate mortgages like it was in the U.S. because it's always something different? Is there a clear sign of what might be the pin that pops this bubble?
Well, again, I guess I would maybe disagree a bit with the premise. And the way I sort of think about housing bubbles is that housing sort of takes on one of two forms at any given point. And kind of the curiously sort of repeating phenomenon with housing bubbles is that housing sort of undergoes, if you will, this phase transition from what's called a basic good to what's called a Giffen good. And basic good being something, you know, you buy more of as the price goes down, and a Giffen good, the exact opposite, something you buy more of as the price goes up. And why on earth would anybody buy more of something as the price goes up? Well, the reason is because it transitions from something you consume, a consumption good, to an investment good, right? You basically, and you saw this in the U.S., you've seen it in every property bubble globally historically, people buy the most of these things, the most house, when the prices are at their most extremes, i.e. they're most unaffordable. And then conversely, when things are incredibly cheap, they buy the least. And that's because people's sort of perception around what a house represents has undergone this phase transition from somewhere I live to an investment back to somewhere I live. And it's sort of this normal and recurring pattern. And so what happens, or at least what happened in the U.S. is, you know, you had these 129s and 228 products, you know, these resetting ARM loans and option ARM loans that, yeah, they were coming up for renewal in early 2017. But the reality is these were largely 1 and 2 year products that had been in place for quite a while, and they had been coming up on resets repeatedly. The issue wasn't so much that. It was really that prices sort of ran out of steam. In other words, you never have delinquencies when prices are appreciating rapidly because it's almost impossible to fall behind because you can just sell the property, right? It's appreciated in value. It's easy to get out of. You have a very liquid market. So the issue was in the U.S. that, and if you think about, take a step back further, If you think about the sequencing of housing markets and the way they evolve, the first thing you see when a market starts to go in the other direction is you see volumes begin to roll over, meaning transaction volumes of homes. So in the U.S., that happened in the middle of 2005. So right around July 05, you had the peak growth rate in transaction volumes in homes. Home prices are a very sticky asset. It takes people a while, sellers, to basically sort of come to grips with the reality, i.e. the market isn't once what it was. They're very reluctant to lower the price at which they're selling their house. So there's about a one-year lag between when volumes inflect from a second derivative standpoint and when prices inflect. So again, if you look at the U.S., volumes peaked from a rate of change standpoint in mid-05, but prices didn't peak and begin to roll until mid-06. And now by the time you got to early 2007, prices were actually decelerating aggressively and it started to roll over negative. And it was the fact that prices were going that made it impossible for people to roll over these mortgages. That was the real catalyst. So you sort of hit peak buyer in mid-05, and then a couple of years later, you hit all these problems in the subprime market. So this whole cottage industry of subprime originators basically collapsed, went bankrupt over the course of the first half of 07. And then it was even a full year and a half after that before you had the full-blown, you know, full-throttle financial crisis that took down Lehman Brothers and the general banking system. And so there's a long lead time is kind of the point between when you see the first signs of problem, which are peaks in volume, and when you see the obvious sort of front page of, I guess, USA Today, when everybody is sort of broadly aware. And so to come back to your original question, which is, well, what's the catalyst? Maybe it's not sort of a great headline, but I sort of think the catalyst is really that you just run out of steam with new buyers. Affordability sort of hits a critical threshold. You experience this phase transition. And what Canada is sort of doing right now between these foreign buyer tax disincentives, the B20 guidelines making it much harder for people, first-time buyers especially, to qualify, all of this is sort of feeding that fuel or that fire that's really going to sort of suck the life out of the would-be sort of first-time buyer. Think of housing as a ladder, right, where everybody sort of simultaneously moves up a rung. But it's not possible if you don't have that first-time buyer getting on that first rung of the ladder. So that's sort of our thesis, is that all these new rules going into effect and sort of confluent with Chinese demand beginning to wane are really going to impact the low end of the Canadian market, and that's going to disrupt the whole property ecosystem across Canada.
My other question is, in the United States, I think a big part of the reason that there was contagion from the housing sector to the banking system and financial system in general is that almost all of the mortgages in question were securitized, and a lot of people who bought the paper didn't understand what they were buying and all the CDO tranches and so forth. Now, as I understand it, for the most part, Canadian real estate mortgages are not securitized that way. They're portfolio lenders. So what do you see in terms of differences of how this would unfold? And how would that difference in terms of securitization of these loans change? And I guess a particular question that's on my mind is, in the U.S., nobody was immune because almost everybody had exposure to the paper, if not to the real estate. If I think about the big Canadian banks, like a Royal Bank of Canada, say, which was famously kind of immune to having problems in the 2008 crisis when the rest of the world was going through a lot of trouble, are they exposed to this, or is it just mortgage lenders in Canada? You know, where's the risk? Where are the shorts? Where's the investment trade here?
Well, I think that's a profoundly important distinction, but I have a lot of conversations with investors on this point, this exact point, and I guess I come at it from a slightly different angle, which is those are definitely reasons why this is a different market than the U.S. And it's like the old Twain shtick about, you know, history doesn't always repeat, but it rhymes. I think the reality here is a little bit different. I don't think you have this sort of ticking time bomb in the form of exotic sort of CDOs, CDO square products that's sort of lacing the balance sheet across the entire sort of banking system. But what I do think you have is you have sort of a enormous amount of concentration risk on the part of first and second lien mortgages across the big six. Like I said earlier, I think the Canadian economy is really become very much a one-cylinder economy that's driven by this property bubble. And then from a valuation standpoint, you have a lot of the large banks, you mentioned Royal Bank as being one, where valuations are north of 2x tangible book value, right? So think about what I said earlier, which is that when home prices are appreciating rapidly, you have all-time lows in delinquency. That's just an absolute function. It's like, you know, the economic equivalent of like a physical law, like gravity, right? When prices are appreciating rapidly and an asset class is inflating, naturally you're going to have very low delinquency rates. And that's exactly what the rear view the last 12 to 18 to 24 months looks like across the big Canadian banks. Our point is that when prices start to slow down, God forbid they should actually start to go negative, those delinquency rates are going to rise. And as they rise, the banks will have to provision for those loan losses, and that's going to erode earnings power. And kind of like what I was saying about the housing system, where you can sort of have this sort of collective mindset undergo this, you know, phase transition of thinking, i.e., one day I think of housing as a consumption good, I need somewhere to live, the next day I think of it as an investment good, look at all these, my friends and family made all this money on real estate, I should be there too, and then all of a sudden the bottom falls out, and now it's back to being consumption good. Bank stock investing is no different. When things are good, you trade these things on earnings. When things aren't great, they start to converge between this earnings multiple and book value. And when things are poor, then you throw out the book and you trade straight to tangible. And then it's sort of, well, how low, how long, you know, how fast? And then it's sort of, what level of discount do I apply to tangible? And our thought process is that if you have a market that's coming off its fastest rate of appreciation in history, and delinquencies are at all-time lows and understated, and you've got the banks reflecting that, trading north of 2x tangible book value, and you think the earnings power is at significant risk because delinquencies are going to rise, then I think there's a lot of downside. And the way I sort of frame it up is that it won't take much of a property correction for earnings power to be largely impaired for the banks across Canada. And in that scenario, you can undergo this pretty rapid phase transition from trading from an earnings multiple to suddenly, well, what are the earnings? The earnings are shrinking. Are the earnings potentially going to go negative for a period of time? Therefore, I trade to tangible, and that equates to 50-60% downside for most of these banks. And so you don't need necessarily this gigantic powder keg of, you know, CDO, you know, exposure to catalyze a significant amount of downside when you're trading at pretty high multiples.
You've got a whole bunch of fantastic slides on Canada. I want to encourage our listeners to check those out. But in the interest of time, I want to make sure we leave room for the rest of this story. Let's move on to Australia. What's the story there? How is it different from Canada? What are we looking at?
So Australia, in a fair number of respects, is analogous to Canada. They, too, are sort of perceived as this resource economy, but in reality are as much, if not more than Canada, sort of a one-cylinder, fire-driven economy, like sort of Canada, where it's sort of this two-horse race between Toronto and Vancouver. Australia mimics that in being sort of a Sydney-Melbourne-driven property market. There are, however, some sort of idiosyncratic factors to Australia that make it, at least in my mind, even more dangerous a housing market than what's going on in Canada. And a few of the big call-outs, one, I think the construction phenomenon in Australia is even more robust. So for instance, we have charts here. Now this deck's a little bit dated. We put our big Australia deck, which is like 150 pages, we put that together in the middle of 16, so now it's about a year and a half old. But just to give you an idea, on slide 26, these are the number of current residential construction cranes operating in the Australian market in the big cities. So we've got Sydney, Melbourne, Perth, and Brisbane here. And this is updated actually through the third quarter of this year. But you can see that right now you've got 350 residential construction cranes operating just in the Sydney market alone. And to put that in perspective, on the next slide, in slide 27 here, this is the RLB Crane Index for all of North America. So this includes the major metro markets of North America, New York, D.C., Boston, Toronto, Chicago, Denver, Phoenix, L.A., San Fran, Portland, Seattle, and Calgary. And across all those markets combined, you had, this is back in early 16, you had about 190 total residential construction cranes as compared with 350 in just Sydney. And I went back and checked on this actually yesterday ahead of our talk here, and that number for North America has actually declined a bit. It's now just under 175. So you literally have more than twice as many cranes building residential towers in Sydney as you do across all of North America, just to put that in perspective. And on slide 28, we just sort of make that apples to apples to truly show sort of the almost ridiculousness of it. So I think there's a lot more construction. The other thing that's going on big time across Australia from a funding standpoint, and again, for Canada, I talked about this idea of how, you know, a hallmark of property bubbles is that you always see creativity on the financing side towards the twilight, right? So in the U.S., it was obviously the subprime loans, the liar loans, the ninja loans, the wrapping of the paper into the securitization structures, and then sort of the rewrapping into collateralized debt obligations and so on and so forth. So in Australia, they have IO loans, just like we had here in the U.S. Now, the predominant term on their IOs is 5 years, but they have 58% payment shocks when those IOs come up for reset. And if you look back at slide 31, really there's two categories of paper in Australia. One is owner-occupiers, the other is investors. For investors, interest-only loans account for north of 70% of all loans. Investors are using interest-only to fund their purchases. And owner-occupiers have been steadily trending higher on the IO side as well. And again, this is what you would expect to see in a market where affordability is transitioning to increasing levels of unaffordability. People are basically reaching to be able to buy the house. They can't qualify based on their income in a traditional mortgage, so instead they go with one that has no principal component to increase their affordability. The problem is these will all come up for reset, and that's increasingly going to start to hit in 2019 next year. So I think that's one of the big factors. To their credit, the Australian regulators, APRA and the RBA, have begun cracking down on this. So they put some limits around the sort of allowable growth rates for the big four Australian banks around IO lending. But again, you know, you talked about, well, what's the catalyst to sort of undo all these markets? And I think that's sort of it, right? You get regulators who sort of finally, usually at the twilight, which is like the worst possible time, they sort of step in with these sort of regulatory interventions intended to sort of facilitate a soft landing, but really they sort of catalyze the undoing. And so another sort of idiosyncrasy to the Australian market is what they call negative gearing. And this one is pretty wild. Basically, you know, I showed earlier how about 3/4 of investment purchases of Australian property are done with interest-only mortgages. Well, there's a provision in the Australian tax code that allows you to deduct losses from rental properties against your income. And so what people do is they go out and they buy homes that produce losses, investment properties that produce losses, and they fund them with interest-only loans. So think about this for a minute. And they do it solely so they can deduct the losses against their income. So you've got a house that you're not actually building any equity in because it's an interest-only funding structure. It's generating operating losses for you. And the only way that you ever realize any return on that is through capital appreciation. So you've got a huge swath of the market set up this way. It's fundamentally nonsensical. But because Australian home prices have risen so much for so long, the idea that they could not keep going up is just this sort of far removed, crazy risk thought that, you know, the average Australian doing this just doesn't really think about. And when I was in Australia and I interviewed numerous people from all sort of walks of life here, sophisticated, unsophisticated, this idea that, you know, negative gearing is sort of a no-brainer is pervasive. So I think that sort of sets the stage for a fair amount of risk. The other thing I found sort of interesting and differentiated about the Australian market is that there's a lot of home equity withdrawal. So if you go to slide 34, one of the sort of hallmarks of the U.S. going into sort of its full bubble phase, if you will, was that you saw the amount of home equity being taken out of homes to basically buy things like vacations, pay for college, buy a car, as well as, you know, home-enhancing things like home improvement, really rose pretty dramatically. So from basically the bulk of the 1990s, even into the early 2000s, home equity withdrawal in the U.S. ran between 1% and 2% of GDP. And then as the bubble sort of kind of ramped up, really in 2004, 2005, 2006, those numbers essentially tripled, even quadrupled, up to around 4%, 4.5% of GDP. So we were curious whether Australia sort of exhibited some of those same tendencies. And we found some pretty interesting data from some academic studies that sort of allowed us to figure out what was the amount of equity being taken out of homes in Australia. And it's a little bit dated. The data set we were able to find covered the 2001 to 2008 period. But what we found was pretty amazing. In any given year over that period, Australians were withdrawing 13 to 15% of the equivalent of their disposable income in home equity. And they were spending it on all manner of things, from car repairs to home improvements to vacations to groceries to medicine. You know, and I think it's sort of pervasive. Like if we kind of have this joke where, you know, in the U.S., although they don't do it anymore, time was when you walked into a McDonald's, they would ask you if you wanted fries with that. And the joke was that, largely based on reality, when you walk into an Australian bank branch to do sort of a routine transaction, they will basically ask you at the end if you'd like some home equity with that. So these are a few of the things about Australia that are kind of interesting. And then more recently, if you go to slide 37, the Australian property market works a little bit differently than either that of the U.S. or Canada. For instance, in the U.S., the only auctions for properties are done in distress, i.e., in the event of foreclosure, and the bank now has the REO, and they're looking to dispose of the property, so they do it through an auction-based process. In Australia, auctions are actually one of the sort of mainstays for selling non-distressed property. So whether it's in Sydney or in Melbourne, there'll be notice that there's going to be an auction for 18 Queen Street. People will show up on that given weekend. There'll be, you know, anywhere from 50 to 100 people sort of gathered around in a circle. There'll be an auction barker there, basically trying to, it's kind of like selling art, trying to sort of get two, three people bidding against each other, create sort of a whole sort of atmosphere, carnival atmosphere of excitement and enthusiasm. Anyway, the clearance rates are basically the percentage of these auctions that actually lead to a sale. And so what's interesting about Sydney is that these clearance rates have been trending lower really over the last year and a half, but then more recently have dropped off pretty sharply. And I talked earlier about the sort of hallmark sequencing of property bubbles and what happens. And again, one of the first things, actually the first thing you see, is that volumes peak from a rate of change standpoint. And they start to slow down. And that's when you know that prices are coming somewhere thereafter, typically on about a one-year lag. And then you start to see the delinquencies pile up. And obviously, the banking sector, from an equity standpoint, take its hit. So the fact that Sydney here is beginning to roll over, definitely notable.
Now, in the United States, that was a securitized market. So if you wanted to play this as an investment trade, you knew the trade was basically credit default swaps to take advantage of the ability to bet against that securitized paper. And the catalyst that people looked for who were most successful is they knew that what would probably break the back of this would be some kind of adjustable rate mortgage reset. And that was what they timed it around. In these markets that are not securitized, both Australia and Canada, what's the trade? Is it shorting the bank directly, or are there other intermediaries? You know, what's the big short here, and how do you know when it's time to put it on?
This has been one of the big challenges, I guess, as an investor looking to try to capitalize on a falling property market in these other countries, whether it be Australia or Canada, is that unlike in the U.S. a decade ago, where there were many different ways to do this, your option set is significantly more limited in both these markets. So in Australia, you've really got the big four banks. You've got CommBank and Westpac and NAB and ANZ. You've got some smaller mortgage insurance companies. You've got a few property developers, Goodman, Mirvac, Lendlease. And then I think the one that sort of comes up from a macro trade standpoint is really just sort of the obvious one, which is the currency. So the Australian dollar, the Canadian dollar. There are credit default swaps that trade on the big Australian banks, the big four. But my understanding is that they're not terribly liquid, not terribly easy to take advantage of. And I think, to be fair, there is a sort of almost a national pride, pretty different in both Australia and Canada. There's like a national pride that sort of goes alongside in Canada, the big six, and in Australia, the big four banks. In my mind, there's a tremendous amount of sort of willingness on the part of the government to backstop these entities from anything sort of overly catastrophic. Whereas in the U.S., now the big banks, of course, are regarded generally as villains. You know, a decade ago, that wasn't the case. They were just sort of neither here nor there. People didn't really feel especially proud of them, but didn't think of them as, you know, this sort of tyrannical industry. And so I think that's going to be a real factor ultimately that sort of helps to prevent anything from sort of catastrophic happening. in both these markets. But that's not to say you couldn't generate some pretty asymmetric returns between here and the point where that backstop really comes into play on the credit default swap side. So, you know, we look primarily at the equities, but anybody sort of combing around for, I guess, more levered ways to think about it, that's an option. In terms of timing, again, the only way I know how to do this is you watch the volumes of the property market. That gives way to price changes on a lag. And then those price changes give rise to delinquency rate inflections. And then ultimately, the stocks finally catch on thereafter. So it can be a long time. It can take a few years. In the U.S., for instance, property transaction volume has peaked in mid-05, prices in mid-06. But you didn't have the XLF, which is, you know, sort of the financials ETF here in the U.S., peak until the first quarter of 07. So it can take quite a while.
Let's go ahead and return to the U.S. and talk about that market. You know, we went through, obviously, a major housing crisis. Prices have pretty much recovered to where they were before the crisis. Are we at risk of another one, or did we learn our lesson? What's the story in the good old U.S. of A?
The U.S. property market is quite strong. I don't think the outlook is for that to inflect in any sort of material longer-term, you know, standpoint. I do think in the short term, you may see a little bit of weakness. There are a couple things. One, you know, from a price standpoint, 2017 was just an unbelievably good year for equities, U.S. equities exposed to housing. There are different ETFs. There's the XHB, the ITB, and then there's like the S5 and S15 home super composites, which are the subsectors of the S&P that look specifically at home builders. And those were generally the best performing categories within the U.S. market over the course of 17. And a lot of that had to do with sort of enthusiasm around, you know, fiscal stimulus from tax cuts. But the sort of yin and the yang to housing stock investing in the U.S. is that what's good for the fiscal side is good for these stocks. But typically, you know, the yang is that, you know, you tend to stoke inflation, and that tends to cause rates to rise and the long end of the curve to move up, which obviously impairs affordability. And there's a incredibly strong inverse correlation between rapid moves up in the long end of the curve and housing equity deflation. So in looking back over three sort of historic periods, you know, you've seen basically housing stocks get cut in half anytime mortgage rates have risen by more than 1.75 points within an 18-month period. And there's three episodes of that in the last 20 years. So that was kind of the concern in late 2016, you know, between the day of the election and call it the end of January 2017, you had this massive move across U.S. equities and the U.S. equity complex. What really got left out of that was the housing component. But then housing stocks basically spent the rest of 2017 catching up because the long end of the curve actually came back in. So rates stayed planted, and suddenly you had this fiscal tailwind without what is sort of the normal sort of offsetting complement, which is mortgage rates moving higher. And so that's kind of where we're at today, is that suddenly you've got the long end of the curve moving up pretty sharply again here. So that's going to probably take a little bit of the air out of the enthusiasm post the tax cut change. So that's one thing to keep in mind. But, you know, bigger picture, housing prices have risen nationally for really since late 2011 was kind of the low watermark. So they've risen pretty steadily. There was a little bit of a cool-off period briefly in 2014 when these so-called qualified mortgage rules were put in place. Kind of took a little bit of the air out for about 9 to 12 months. But notwithstanding that kind of speed bump, the U.S. housing market has generally been inflating pretty steadily. In the last few years, prices have been rising between 5 and 6% nationally year over year. I think what's going on now is kind of interesting. You have this sort of severe shortage of supply of homes for sale across the U.S., and where it's most acute is at the sort of entry level, at the low end. And so normally, sort of generally regarded as quote-unquote a balanced market, is about 6 months of supply. That's sort of a level at which neither buyers nor sellers have sort of excess bargaining power. And so in that environment, what you tend to see is home prices generally rise at a rate consistent with inflation, right? So if inflation's running around 2, you'd see home prices in that environment going up by 2 to 3. But what we've got instead of 6 month supply is currently around 3.5, which is all-time lows for aggregate U.S. housing supply. And so as a result, you're seeing home prices accelerate. And so prices are now rising up between 6 and 7% nationally, and that pressure is going to continue. And the reason is that they're not building enough homes. So in the most recent data, single-family starts were running at about 930,000. That's seasonally adjusted, annualized. Our math shows that that number would need to be all the way up around 1.5 to 1.6 million, up from the current 930,000, in order to essentially equilibrate that supply-demand imbalance, get the 3.5 months of inventory back up to 6 months. And so the good news, bad news is, well, the good news is that's really good for builders because it basically means there's a path for them to basically double output if they can source the land and if they can source the incremental construction labor, which both of which are sort of hard to come by these days. But the point is there's sort of a long-term, you know, tailwind there, not going away at least for the next 5 to 6 years. And the reason why is because if you look at the demographics of the U.S., we're at a really interesting point. So right now, you know, people talk about the millennials. The millennials are an incredibly important generation from a housing standpoint. If you look at the numbers, and I'm trying to remember if I put a chart in here. Unfortunately, I did not. But we have this chart that shows the number of people in each age cohort, right? So the number of people who are 26, the number of people who are 27, and so on and so forth. And what's interesting is that currently, the average age at which people rent their first property is 26 to 27. Meanwhile, the average age at which they buy their first home is 32 to 33. And what you've got is this thing sort of creeping into the investment lexicon, peak millennial, which is the largest cohorts of millennials right now are those who are 26 and 27, i.e. first-time renters. So meanwhile, you've got a much smaller number of 32 and 33-year-old millennials. And so what that means is that over the coming 5 to 6 years, as these 26, 27-year-olds become 32, 33-year-olds, you're going to have this sort of tidal wave tailwind of millennials moving out of renting into home ownership for the very first time. And behind those 26 and 27-year-olds, there are far smaller numbers of 25, 24, 23, and 22-year-olds. So what you've got sort of coming down the pike from a housing standpoint in the U.S. is you're definitely at peak in terms of rental demand, and you're going to start to see that industry begin to, which has benefited, by the way, over the last 5 to 6 years from enormous tailwinds demographically, but they're now just about to be on the other side of that. Meanwhile, you're going to have enormous tailwinds shifting into first-time homebuyers. And so if you're, you know, a large publicly traded builder who has, you know, a focus increasingly gravitating toward first-time buyers in, you know, some of these states like Florida and Texas and elsewhere, you've got the wind at your back here for the next 5, 6 years. And in terms of sort of affordability, which is kind of the longer-term governor on what is, you know, sort of possible across the housing landscape, nationally, affordability trends still look incredibly favorable. Home ownership relative to renting is still much closer to its all-time lows than its all-time highs. So that looks very favorable. Now, once you sort of dive into certain select cities like San Francisco, Manhattan, Boston, the affordability dynamic there is much less compelling. And by the way, that's also part of the reason why these people, these sort of peak millennials, are sort of now moving out of the cities once again. You know, there's sort of this, the last 5 years, this sort of narrative around, you know, these people want to live in urban centers, you know, they're different than previous generations. All of that is sort of this fallacy. Really, they're no different than previous generations. They're just more sort of stunted or lagged from a sort of progression time standpoint. And so what's going to happen here over the next 5 years is the millennial generation is going to do the same thing that previous generations has done. They're, you know, going to start to want to move out of the city, buy a house, get married, have kids, have a backyard and a dog and some property or some land. And so that's going to be kind of the next 5 years, what you're going to see increasingly across the U.S.
Josh, I cannot thank you enough for a fantastic interview. I want to encourage our listeners to check out the wealth of graphs and charts that we didn't have time to get to. And I'd also, as we close, like to go to that last slide and talk about where our listeners can follow more of your work. We do have a large institutional audience, which I know is your role at HedgEye. Where do our institutional listeners find out more about what you do there? And also for individual investors, our friend Dan Holland at HedgEye has been kind enough to extend an offer on your Market Edges product to get a free trial. Please tell us about that as well.
Sure. So, actually, we have a little promotional slide here at the end of the deck. You know, we cater really to two different sets of investors, institutional investors, which is who I primarily work with. If you have any interest in seeing more of our work, you can email us at sales@hedgeye.com. We also have an individual investor product. We actually have a number of different offerings. As you mentioned, we are running a deal right now. You can get a free month of Market Edges. All the details around that product and actually all of our different products can be found on our website, hedgeye.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Josh. And I've been looking for a while for a guest to have a real estate focused show. And Josh didn't disappoint. What really stood out for you in that interview?
Well, you know, I had to agree when Josh disagreed with me. I had to agree with him because I was thinking about the mechanics of a bubble and how it happens in terms of how stock market bubbles happen. And I think he's right that the way people think about housing, is it a place to live or is it a speculative investment that you're going to flip and try to make a buck on? I think that is the key driving psychology behind investors in these housing bubbles. So I was glad to hear his view because I think he was right in disagreeing with me on that one. But for you, Patrick, as a Canadian, you've been very outspoken about the real estate bubble in Canada for many years, including, I mean, you perfectly nailed your call on the Vancouver market topping back in 2016. I think you were like right to the week on where the top was going to be. How has this story been playing out within your narrative, and where are we going from here in terms of Canadian real estate?
All right. Well, you know, I wanted to first off just make let everyone know that we included a short PDF of charts on the Canadian real estate market that's in addition to the one provided by Josh in the research roundup email that we're going to show. And on the first chart there, we have the Vancouver market. And if you look on that chart back in 2015, going into 2016, you literally saw that parabolic rise. It almost looked like Bitcoin right at the end. And just like back a couple weeks ago in December, when I was saying that it's likely that the peak levels of Bitcoin could come in 2017 because it was this parabolic rise. Usually the time frame narrows because it's just the price is appreciating so quickly that gravity eventually takes over, and you can usually identify that within a small window. But what was interesting about that is that was really driven by a lot of narratives. Obviously, there was the whole Chinese money laundering stories and all the capital controls associated with Chinese money flowing into Vancouver. And there was these stories of there was 66,000 empty homes in Vancouver area, and all of these investors were using tax evasion strategies, not reporting any of this in there. And there was all of these things that were just driving and fueling this, and it was really an interesting kind of narrative of how the whole thing came together to create a top. So I was doing a presentation. I was speaking at the Money Show in Toronto, and I was did a presentation talking about the Vancouver market and the eventual top. And my narrative, which ended up not being the catalyst, was very similar to Kyle Bass's. Right, it was inspired, in fact, by Kyle Bass's. This is the idea that China was going through this massive credit expansion. happened, and there was all of this money flowing out of China as their foreign exchange reserves were depleting, and this was like a tidal wave flowing into the Australian market and Canadian market and London market and into California and all sorts of places like this where the real estate prices were surging. And my view was well, it was going to end with China ending it. They were going to put up massive capital controls, and or there was going to be some sort of a credit event that was going to seize up everything. And once the money stopped flowing, then one of the major precipitating factors driving it would have reversed it. But it ended up being a different catalyst. It really was the British Columbia government out in Vancouver that really stepped in with this 15% foreign ownership tax coming in, and then they did the empty home tax and all sorts of these other things. And they basically derailed the advance with government policy. And that ended up being the short-term catalyst. And you know, really, you can say I want to take credit for being close to the top in terms of on the Vancouver market. I was way too early on calling it on the entire Canadian market because you know, a lot of really interesting things happened after that top.
Well, and that, you know, I certainly, hindsight's always 20/20. I thought when it was so clear that there was a reversal right after the announcement of that 15% tax, it was very clear from the charts, okay, finally the top is in on Vancouver. And I thought that was the top in Canadian housing. I thought that was it. And it, of course, in hindsight, it's pretty clear that it makes perfect sense that if all of a sudden the problem is a tax that's a local tax in Vancouver, Toronto is, you know, clearly without, I go by the dim sum index. If you want to know where Asian housing happens, the best dim sum in North America, hands down, is Vancouver. Second best is Toronto. So where are they going to go if you can't go to Vancouver because of a tax? It led to, I think, a big run-up in Toronto housing, which should have been easy to see coming. I sure didn't see it coming. What happened there?
Well, that's exactly it. I think that's where I got it wrong, because I assumed that there was this big, massive surge, and once the foreign money kind of dried up, it would impact everywhere. And instead, because it wasn't a catalyst driven from the China side, it was a catalyst driven by government. With the Ontario government, where Toronto is situated, not having the same policy, it actually just shifted the entire tidal wave east. And the moment the Vancouver market cooled off, suddenly, over the next following 9 months, the Toronto market just surged. And so I have some charts that, if you look at charts number 3, 4, and 5, just 3 and 4, we're talking about Toronto and Markham, where Markham was in the northern Toronto area where there's a very strong Chinese community. And it was sort of like, in my mind, the epicenter of a lot of that money flow. And it just came over like a tidal wave. And we saw, in some cases, 40, 50, 60% rises in houses in just a 9 month span. In just on these charts, the last 3 months of that surge in the January, February, March period, some of these houses were going up hundreds of thousands of dollars in just a couple months. It was just this big, massive surge. And it was interesting. So this big foreign money was coming in, and there was this huge hysteria. And then came what I thought was a really interesting event. There was the pinnacle sort of came in March of 2017, and what's amazing is it came with the Canadian Real Estate Wealth Expo that happened in downtown Toronto. And what ended up happening is that the featured guests of that was Tony Robbins and Pitbull, right? And here at a real estate conference comes in Tony Robbins and Pitbull. They had created so much froth. They could pretty much sell ice to an Eskimo. And they came in there, and there was all of this froth. And I give kudos and a call out to Tim Burgeon, who wrote a blog that we shared with our Macro Voice listeners back in March. The title of it was, "I Attended the Top of the Canadian Housing Market So You Didn't Have To." And what's amazing is literally within weeks after that event came in the final sort of peak blow off of Toronto housing. And really at that moment, we similarly saw all of the government intervention that followed. And really, whether it's at the government level, whether it's at the central bank level with Stephen Poloz, there became a coordinated effort to try to cool off the Canadian market. And whether that was by implementing foreign ownership taxes in Toronto with a 15% there, but as well, they started forcing people that are applying for the CMHC insurance to actually need to qualify at a 200 basis point, or at least stress test at a 200 basis point higher mortgage rate than what the actual mortgage rates were. And so what they synthetically did was start cutting off people from being able to access huge mortgages. And now there's even new mortgage rules coming out that just took into effect last week. I mean, Josh was just mentioning in the interview, which is even further an attempt to cool it off. So, you know, we have this real scenario where we probably have seen peak prices, right? And as those charts show, things have been pretty much cooling off. And it's interesting because year over year, most of the real estate is actually flat because there was this massive 30% surge, and then that 30% was completely given back. So it depends on, I guess, what perspective you put it in there. But really, we've seen the Canadian market already cooling off. So just like Josh was saying, there's this transitory period between this. And so now that we've already seen things cooling off, it'll be very interesting to see how long it's going to take for that to start to translate into the fundamentals in Canadian macroeconomics data points, right?
Well, and also, of course, to see what happens as a result, this speculative buildup from a lot of it was Asian money going into these markets. Where does that leave us? And I know when I've been to Vancouver many times, speaking to local residents, you know, they know it's this big bubble. They know that it's kind of like buying very high. But at the same time, there's young people, millennials, who want to have a family and own a home. And they're kind of like, it seems crazy to buy, but it seems crazy not to. And they don't know what to do. So it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out in terms of where the low is. Takeaway for me from the whole conversation, Markham. Now I know where to go for dim sum in Toronto. In Vancouver, it's the south side of town, and Richmond is the right place to go. So now I know Markham is the place. I also know, big picture trading, I know you're working with your members and actually trading this. So how do we translate this macro story about housing in Canada to actual trades that you can put on?
Well, this is where Josh had it right, in the fact that there's this extended lag time. And we saw it happen in the U.S. market too, right? There was peak activity, peak prices, you know, 2005, 2006. Prices started to react through 2007. But the real economics and financial impact of it didn't really translate until 2008, 2009. And I think that this is the same case here. I remember even back in 2005, there was no shortage of analysts and commentators and pundits who are out there looking to short Canadian banks, whether it was the Mark Cohodes shorting Home Capital Trust or any number of these analysts going right after all the major Canadian banks. But what's amazing is how there's this lag time that has not manifested this in any impact on the banks. Like, so if you give an example, you know, back in 2016, if someone thought, well, that was the peak and started shorting these bank stocks, I'll give an example, CIBC Bank was trading like at $60 back in 2016, has now surpassed $100 on the upside. So somebody who's short, even if they're dollar cost averaging their short position because they know it's going to come to roost, well, I mean, they're down $40 a share on their Canadian bank stocks, and they pretty much need a 50% correction in the stock just to probably get to break even net of all the dividends that they're having to deal with in being short. And so this has been a real timing issue. I mean, I took a couple pot shots at taking shorts on the Canadian banks myself, but I used options to do it, right? And so, and this is where I think options are incredibly valuable because they give you an out if you're early. So, you know, I took a shot at taking a short on Royal Bank thinking there was a rollover occurring, and I bought some put options on Royal, and guess what? I was early. And in the end, I lost a couple bucks on the put options, but guess what? I'm not down $30, $40, $50 a share on the stocks and stuck in a short position. I'm waiting to come back. Guess what? I get to start the trade fresh. You know, the beautiful thing about options is you can take a couple stabs at trying to catch turn points in this. One way or another, like Josh was suggesting there, eventually it's going to impact the banks, whether it's through mortgage origination, whether it's through increases in non-performing loans and mortgage defaults. They only start happening after your prices reverse. And there's a long period of a lag. But like he was saying, right now, these banks are trading on their earnings. But at some point, they're going to be start trading toward their book values or their tangible values. And something like that could cause a big correction in these bank stocks. And there may be an amazing opportunity to profit on the downside. It's a mixture of a little bit of technical analysis and some strategies that limit your risk, right?
And we should, of course, remind people, and our newer listeners may not realize, that you are in the business, Patrick, of teaching people how to trade. Options trading is just one of the several course offerings you have at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to have to end it there, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in. We really could use your help with promoting the show. The more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. So please, if you haven't yet, go to macrovoices.com, register your free account. Only takes a few minutes. We're not going to spam you. We're not going to try to sell you anything. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email every week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to download all of the cool content that comes from our feature interview guests, as well as the very best content that our research team could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
All right, well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Josh. You'll also find the link to the chart book for Josh Steiner's presentation, as well as the chart we talked about here in the post game. There's also an article from BlackRock on the geopolitical risks worth worrying about in 2018. I thought it was really interesting to see what was on their mind. And of course, there's also a link to that David Rosenberg piece on the 2018 market and macro outlook, which I thought was also really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at MacroVoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.